Park Place meeting, talk given Saturday morning, 21st May 1977. Let me first read two paragraphs from this discourse of the Buddha. The greater emptiness, the discourse on the greater emptiness. The greater discourse on emptiness. Wherefore, Ananda, conduct yourselves towards me with friendliness, not with hostility. And for a long time, that will be for your welfare and happiness. And how, Ananda, do disciples conduct themselves towards a teacher with hostility, not with friendliness? And then he explains, the Buddha explains, that he gives the teaching which is for their welfare and fulfillment, but the disciples do not pay sufficient attention to it. They turn away from the teacher's instruction, and therefore they do not realize the goal. And this is the behavior which is hostility towards the teacher, not friendliness. And the Buddha goes on, and how, Ananda, do disciples conduct themselves to a teacher with friendliness, not with hostility? And here, of course, the reverse statement is made, that the disciples do listen, do attend, diligently practice, realize the fruit of living the holy life. And this is the meaning of the disciples conducting themselves with friendliness, not with hostility towards the teacher. And he concludes thus. And I, Ananda, will not proceed with you as does a potter with an unbaked vessel not fully dry. I will speak, Ananda, constantly reproving, constantly cleansing. That which is the pith will stand fast. Thus spoke the Lord. Delighted, the venerable Ananda rejoiced in what the Lord had said. We tried out an experiment yesterday. We were a small party at lunch. And we agreed to relax the rule of silence at the meal. And at first, the room was still pervaded with silence, although there was gentle conversation. And towards the end of the meal, it was slightly more animated, without breaking the silence. But in the evening, something else happened. In the evening, did we flow into gentle conversation, not disturbing the peace and the rhythm and the harmony of silence, which in fact always includes all sound and speech? Or did we erupt into noise? There is a vast gulf between gentle flowing conversation, which can be like a poem, which can be like music, which is the sound of silence in eternity, heard through the beauty of sound in speech. Mankind has lost the art of conversation. Conversation. Consider this carefully. And in connection with it, recall that on Tuesday morning, I think it was, we talked of discipline in the religious context. Discipline means learning. Learning in which manner? In the religious context, it means learning by growing happily. Growing happily. If our practice of silence at meals is merely a routine enforced upon ourselves by an imposed rule, we are mechanically silent. We are not growing happily. Therefore, when the imposed rule is lifted, we are back at square one. We have not grown. See, one does not achieve the kingdom of heaven or nirvana like climbing up to Everest, the peak of Everest. Because once you've climbed up to the peak of Everest, you have no alternative but in a very, very few minutes to climb down again. Whereas, if you have grown some remarkable faculty, drawn it out of your inner being, you can stay on the peak of Everest as happily as we stay down here in this comfortable room, which is a different thing altogether. Growing happily. Now, when we practice, when we carry out the suggestion to be silent, whether it be at meals or anywhere else, it applies in all cases. It doesn't mean sitting or in our meditative walking, moving about, preoccupied with our self-concerns. It doesn't mean that. The example of sitting at meals, we are a large company, 50 people nearly. When we sit silently at the meal, Notice how the mind gets, the brain is chattering away hard, mostly with self-concerns, or with something which is on the brain, like a tune, got such and such a tune on the brain, you see, it just goes compulsively on and on. It's not that. Try and be sensitively awake to all around, to everything around. The salt, the pepper, the next person's need for what he might be wanting at table, and so forth. Sensitively awake to our fellow human beings. They and oneself together constitute one humanity, one mankind. This way the sense of all humanity grows and grows and grows. Because we are sensitively awake to a few members composing humanity who are by us, around us. And if one can practice that way, one will find the reality of what we call loving kindness, metta. The reality of compassion, karuna, growing inside us, growing. And if it grows, really, one never falls down from that standard. Like we fell down, erupting into noise because the enforced rule of imposed silence was withdrawn. You see? It's like that. And one's own psyche becomes so sensitive, so quiet, so naturally and sensibly, sensible in the common, in the meaning of common sense, so sensibly considerate of others, that one knows without saying a word what the other one needs. Let me recount one account in the discourses, where the monks are gathered together. It is the first watch of the night, and the Buddha doesn't say a word. They have gathered to listen to him. He waits in complete silence. The second watch of the night passes. Still doesn't say a word. Towards the end of the third watch, the Buddha says, "The assembly is still not pure." A most significant, an extraordinary story. Moggallana, one of his great disciples, a disciple with highly developed psychic sensitivities, then gets up and moves amongst the gathered monks. And there is a very large number of them present. not numbering 30s and 40s, but by the hundreds they are there. And he asks one particular monk to get up and move out of the assembly. And the account goes on to say how this monk acknowledges how his mind was deeply disturbed with what are called the hindrances, thoughts and emotions of greed and malevolence, resentment and all that kind of thing. And Moggallana comes back and sits down and tells the Lord, "Lord, the assembly is pure now." And the meeting proceeds. He knows with his mind the mind of others. This sensitivity grows. Think of the extraordinary power that can be released out of oneself to be a beneficial influence. Not temporarily, but permanently to all around, if this sensitivity has come to its full fruition. This is one of the real clairvoyant psychic powers that lies dormant in so many human beings. And this is how one may rightly use such power. Isn't it a wonderful account? Remember, there is no such thing as condemnation involved in it. Here was the situation. This is what was necessary to do, and it was done with complete understanding, with complete compassion and gentleness of manner. No question of retribution or anything like that. The only way in which retribution naturally functions is within ourselves. You may recall, I have said over and over again, no one can escape karma, because every single thought, feeling, word, deed registers, makes an impress upon our own brain and whole organism. And that which is impressed there is a force which is constantly operative. You can't stop living forces which constitute your organism from operating. So that is why we cannot escape the ill results of our ill feelings, ill thoughts. This does not mean that one is not well aware of someone's wrongdoing, or right doing as the case may be, someone else's wrongdoing and so forth. One can be well aware without condemnation. One is therefore not an instrument of retribution upon the other person. But the ill force within us, because it constitutes us as living beings, that ill force is a living force, and it exercises retribution upon our own psychophysical being. This is how the retributive aspect of karma works. You will find a suggestion of this, and a powerful suggestion too, in the New Testament also, but in quite a different form. I won't digress into that at the moment because we need our time today. So let us bear this in mind, that through the practice of silence, a silence in which we do not let ourselves become self-preoccupied, self-concerned with our own worries and flurries and whatnot and whatnot, you see, loving kindness and compassion grows. Just naturally grows. As you know, speech plays a very important part in our lives. It is the most constantly used means of communication between man and man. And even, in small measure, between man and the animals. You can talk to your pet dog or cat or bird or something, and they understand. That is not to suggest that they know the dictionary meanings of the words of the language that you use. But the intonation, the sound, is recognized by them. It always fills me with wonder, real wonder, when the cat or dog at home answers to the name that you have given it. And you will notice that the way it answers to the name is quite different from the way it responds to anything else that it has become accustomed to be told. Isn't it extraordinary? How does it recognize its name? That this refers to me. Speech. The mysterious aspect of it's a mystery to me anyway. The mysterious aspect of speech. Well, speech is of tremendous importance. I have quoted almost in full what the Buddha says about speech in early Indian religious thought. He's talking about the moralities, and do bear in mind, he calls them the minor details of mere morality. He's not expounding the major aspects of profound morality. Just the minor details of mere morality. It's very significant that he uses that term. And he speaks about himself. And he says that if someone were to talk about me, he would be rightly speaking of me if he says these things. Putting away the killing of living things, Gotama the recluse holds aloof from the destruction of life. He has laid the cudgel and the sword aside. He lives scrupulous and full of mercy, friendly and compassionate to all creatures that have life. No question of any sort of retributive action or punishment or anything in relation to his disciples. No 30 blows or whatever it may be not even words spoken in harshness. When he has to reprove, he says, he presents the whole truth of the monk's default, but he speaks them with complete compassion and gentleness. This is forgotten. When we read the words, we think, dear me, he's knocking the daylights out of the monk. But he's not doing anything of the sort. He's letting light into the monk's whole being, not knocking the daylights out. Putting away the taking of what is not given, abstaining from taking what is not given, I would like to add the little adverb, what is freely given. Gautama the recluse lives as one who takes only what is given, who waits for what is given. And by not stealing, he lives with a self become pure. Putting away unchastity, Gautama the recluse is chaste. He holds himself aloof, far off from the vulgar village practice of promiscuity. This refers to the sort of prevailing custom in those days with regard to the relationship of the sexes. The young ones after reaching puberty, not in all societies in India, in social groups, but in some social groups, especially those living in the foothills and so forth. Some of them, you see, they were allowed 1 month during the year to mate quite freely as their natural inclinations impelled them. But that did not mean that they indulged themselves sort of without any restraint. They picked and chose. And when they found somebody who really was their affinity sexually, they settled down in marriage later on. They were then and were betrothed. And a year or two later, or whatever the time may have been, they were married and husband and wife in the ordinary legal sense also of the word. You see, so it is more with reference to that sort of custom than in the modern sense of the word of promiscuity. Putting away, now listen to what he says about speech. Putting away lying words, Gautama the recluse holds himself aloof from falsehood. He speaks truth. From the truth he never swerves. Faithful and trustworthy, he breaks not his word to the world. Putting away slander, Gautama the recluse holds himself aloof from calumny. What he hears here, he repeats not elsewhere to raise a quarrel against the people here. What he hears elsewhere, he repeats not here to raise a quarrel against the people there. Thus does he live as a binder together of those who are divided, an encourager of those who are friends, a peacemaker, a lover of peace, impassioned for peace, a speaker of words that make for peace. It's strange to hear the Buddha use the word impassioned in this context, because he's always talking of dispassionateness, impassioned for peace. Putting away harshness of speech, Gautama the recluse holds himself aloof from harsh language. Remember this in connection with his having to reprove the monks. Doesn't speak harshly to them, but wholly, truly, terrible things are told them. Whatsoever word is blameless, pleasant to the ear, lovely, reaching to the heart, urbane, pleasing to the people, agreeable to the people, such are the words he speaks. And in this connection, although it is not here, but in other contexts, he says that I do not argue with the world. I neither concur with what they say, nor do I disagree with what they say. Why? The conversation of the worldling belongs to a context and is confined to a context utterly different from the transcendent context of the Buddha. Putting away frivolous talk, Gautama the recluse holds himself aloof from vain conversation. And in another context he uses the term low conversation. And he defines what is low conversation. Talk about kings, robbers, ministers of state, war, terrors, battles, foods, drinks, clothes, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives and relationships, equipages, villages, towns, cities, countries, tales about women and heroes, gossip at street corners or wells, ghost stories, desultory talk, speculations about the land and sea, about becoming this and not becoming this, that and the other. That's what he calls vain or low conversation. Remember, this is for those who are concerned, wholly concerned with the religious life. We're slightly difficult to apply that fully in our modern world. In season, he speaks, in accordance with fact. A speaker on the goal, a speaker on Dhamma, the teaching, a speaker on discipline. He speaks words that are worth treasuring, with similes at the right time, that are discriminating and connected with the goal. Now there are 19 lines of print occupying all that he has said there with regard to speech. And that is the fourth point of the moralities. The minor details of mere morality. The fourth point. 19 lines in print. And the first three and the last one, which concerns drink, to abstain from drink and so forth, you see, and to say that he abstains from adorning or ornamenting himself, etc., 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 occupies another 19 lines. See, four of the important moralities occupy the same space in his exposition as the one morality concerned with speech. It gives us some idea of the real importance of watching, being watchful, mindful of speech and the manner of speech. He describes all that. And in this connection, let us hear the words of Hui Neng, the great 6th patriarch of China. First, just a few words about views. Erroneous views keep us in defilement, while right views remove us from it. But when we are in a position to discard both of them, right views and wrong views alike, then we are absolutely pure. You appreciate the point. With freedom from possessing views of any sort, the psyche is utterly transparent. The light of pure mind, the universal mind, finds no obstruction at all within the living being. And therefore, it means that oneself is the living vehicle of transcendence. And he goes on, Bodhi, wisdom, is immanent in our essence of mind. Immanent. An attempt to look for it elsewhere is erroneous. Then he says this very significant thing. Within our impure mind, the pure one is to be found. You find this identical teaching in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad also. He proceeds, provided we keep a constant eye on our own faults, we cannot go astray from the right path. Then he says something which is so applicable to human life today, just as much as it has been through the ages. He who treads the path in earnest sees not the mistakes of the world. Somehow I don't think he quite means that, but sees them in the way that the man with the worldly outlook sees. If we find fault with others, we ourselves are also in the wrong. Extraordinary statement, isn't it? If we find fault with others, we ourselves are also in the wrong. when other people are in the wrong, we should ignore it. This is what Huineng says, contrast with the words of the Buddha. So, Ananda, I will continue to reprove, etc. Do not regard me with hostility, but with friendliness. I'll repeat that. When other people are in the wrong, we should ignore it, for it is wrong for us to find fault. By getting rid of the habit of fault finding, we cut off a source of defilement. When neither hatred nor love disturb our mind, serenely we sleep. One must be careful about interpreting the use of the English word love in all these contexts. It always means affection which is possessive and or attached. Hatred and attached affectionateness. Both are to be avoided. When neither hatred nor affection disturb our mind, serenely we sleep. One word now in connection with meditation. We all know that the laid down systems of meditation have been laid down in so many words. Whatever is verbally formulated, and if it is verbally followed, imagining that we are meditating, we are only going through a verbal ritual. Listen to what Tilopa, one of the great Tibetan gurus, has said. Do not imagine, he has said this in connection with meditation, do not imagine, do not think, do not analyze, do not meditate in the sense of going through merely a verbal ritual. You might as well go through all the laid down rituals of any religion, you see. Do not reflect. Keep the mind in its natural state. If you like, we can discuss this tomorrow afternoon. It's a question worthwhile discussing. What is the meaning of keeping the mind in its natural state? Letting it be itself in its wholeness. That's what Tilopa said. And in another Tibetan, again a Tibetan treatise, you will find this. It has been said, by entirely refraining from forming thoughts and mental visualizations, by maintaining the bodily calmness of a sleeping babe, the bodily calmness of a sleeping babe, and endeavoring meekly and zealously to follow the Guru's authorized teachings, there will undoubtedly arise the simultaneously born state, the state of nirvana. It's termed the simultaneously born state, because nirvana and samsara remain inseparable. Nirvana has to shine through samsara, and that is the wonderful thing man can bring about. But note very carefully the bodily calmness of a sleeping babe. When one is not asleep, the practice of that silence, which is this very sensitive awakenedness to everything around, and that silence, the true silence, includes all sound.